accession number 20671, reel 8.
Because as you go onto one pontoon, it sinks, and so the bit in front of you goes up and you go down. So you're permanently going uphill, and yet you're only going across. And you're going, the current is bowing the things, it's not in a straight line, so you're having to turn toward it all the time. It's quite a, and it's quite a wide river, it's about a kilometre wide where we crossed into that point.
Do you know where you crossed it?
I don't know the place, no, exactly. Yeah.
So you're on German soil?
Yes, proper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leo Rumley, end of reel 7. Leo Rumley, reel 8. So, into Germany.
Yeah.
Do you know about what date it was, roughly?
I don't know.
Okay. So where did you go?
I know it was springtime, and... We were told that now we're on German soil, to be extra vigilant and extra careful, and we can no longer rely upon the civilians for anything. So my job as main egg gatherer for our carrier was a bit more difficult because...
You'd been collecting eggs all the way, had you?
Well, I was nominated because I was a country boy, you know, I would know where to find eggs. So every time we stopped through France and Belgium and Holland and we heard chickens, send Rumley off for the eggs, so I used to have to go and get the eggs.
And where did you cook the eggs?
Well, cooking was always done on a wonderful British invention. You know, when we went across to France, we were all given little Primus stoves. The scouts used to use them, and they were paraffin, and you had a little cup on the top you had to fill with petrol, and then you had to pump it up, and then you get high pressure paraffin coming through, which you light. But the jet that it used to come through always used to get bunged up with soot, and you were given a little pricker to prick it out. But the wire on these prickers was always bending over and so on. So I should think within 2 days of landing in Normandy, they were thrown over the hedge. And the British compromise was very simple. We got a bucket and filled it full of sand, right? And when you wanted to cook, all you did was take the bucket off, stand it on a brick, fill it full of petrol, set fire to it. You've got an instant fire. The petrol wouldn't run away because it was soaking to the sand.
It wouldn't explode then?
No, and the sand couldn't burn, so it was permanent, didn't need to renew it. And under every vehicle you saw leaving Normandy, underneath the back axle would be a bucket full of sand, and that was the stove.
Right.
Absolutely reliable,
yeah.
100%,
yeah. Could use it
never any problem.
Yeah.
And, all the cooking utensils was black as the ace.
But you had adult frying pans or?
Well, we had mess tins and things like that. And
so you
well, you acquired as you went along, you know, from deserted farmhouses and some that weren't deserted, but you acquired what you wanted as you went along.
Right. So you could do your own catering, as it
were? Oh, right? Yes.
You know, just
put
a bit of something and you...
That's right, yes.
Do a fry.
Well, every day we used to get the our allocation from these 14-man packs, which was... sufficient for one man for 14 days or 14 men for one day. And they always had this exactly the same thing in every time, and it's monotonous. Good, but monotonous. So we used to save all our sardines, because nobody in our crew liked sardines, so we saved all the tins of sardines, and whenever we could and we stopped anywhere, we'd exchange them for bread or whatever, and things like that. So, and you all took it in turns to do the cooking, so... whatever it was.
So what was the favourite eggs? And
so, well, the staple diet was meat and veg. Mm-hmm. And tinned bacon, which was American tinned bacon, which was, you couldn't fry it. You could only eat it up. They had a paper lining, wrapped into a paper lining, if you know what I mean, waterproof paper lining, to stop it sticking. But you couldn't fry it. It was pre-cooked anyway, and so on. and tin puddings and biscuits and jam and butter and toilet paper, matches and cigarettes and the usual things.
Yeah.
And
so
but eggs were the supplement, you see. Yeah. And whenever we stopped anywhere, they used to say, "Come on, get the eggs." Just a little aside, I remember on one occasion, and this is very hard to believe, but we pulled into a farm, and the farm was off the road, and past the farm, the road ran further on past the farm, down to some outbuildings, and we pulled into the main farm, and they said to me, "We've got some eggs here." So I had to cross the road back again to the hen coops, and unbeknownst to me, further down the track was a German 88, and they'd seen me leave the main building, cross the farm road to the hen coops, and of course I got the beret full of eggs, all walking back delicately with the eggs, you see, and just as I get to the building, an 88 took the corner of the building clean off just as I walked past it. I thought, that's a bit expensive, an 88 shell just for one man. And a few eggs.
I mean, did you get your eggs back?
Oh, yes, I know. No, no, no.
You're quite cool.
Yes.
So, into Germany, where did you go when you got onto German soil?
Well, it didn't last very long once we got onto German soil. There was a place that we came across, and again, this is, I can't remember the name of it, but the railway station was alight, was burning furiously, and some of the people said that there were people in the basement of this railway station. So Joe, the dispatch rider, and I said we'd go and have a look. So we went down into this basement, and the buildings on ground level were blazing, and we found this step down to this basement, and we went down there, and as we got down there, we heard a door close, and we looked, and we could just see this door closing, and quick as a flash, Joe took his Sten gun and sent a burst into this door jamb, you know, just as the door was closing. Well, the noise, you would not believe it, of the Sten gun being fired in closed air. We'd only ever heard it out in the open, which was, it was like a miniature pop gun, you know, the Sten gun. But in the close circumstances, the noise was terrific. And it took quite a chunk of the door off as it passed. And we heard this woman scream, and she'd just gone through the door. And imagine half the door jamb being ripped off with bullets. And when we got to her, she'd got bits of wood stuck in her arm and her side and her leg and everywhere, big, big chunks of wood, you know. She was in a terrible state. But I don't know what she was doing down there, so we just sent the medic down to sort her out.
So was it just her down there, or were there lots of people?
Well, we had another look, and we went into one room, and it was no windows or anything, and just one light in the middle of the room. And the whole room was full of, for want of a better description, metal racks from floor to ceiling, but only quite small. And they were filled with banknotes. Must have been billions of marks, Deutschmarks. Must have been billions of them in that room.
Do you think that was, you know, the property of criminals, or was it something to do with the bank?
Well, we found out when we got into this place that it was being defended by fanatical Hitler youth, young lads, 15 and 16 and even younger than that, and they would not surrender. They would not surrender.
Hence, fire was burning.
I don't know how many we killed. I don't know how many of them we killed, quite honestly. But they just wouldn't give up. They were fanatics.
So who were these people in the cellar? They were German civilians, weren't they?
I think that the woman there probably knew about the money that the vaults of this railway station had been built, and I think it was bomb-proof probably, because it was very thick, solid concrete, everything about it. and I think it was this was a Nazi stronghold, an SS centre, and I think the money was there for them in case of an emergency. They need to make a getaway, but they'd blown it. Mm. We were too quick for them.
We were too quick.
Oh, they were, definitely were. Yeah, yes, oh yeah. They were running about in between buildings with swastikas. Great big red and black swastika flags.
So, although all the resistance wasn't just sort of firing at you, was it? I mean, there was some blatant.
Oh no! Yeah. Yeah. And we found a house there that had the most sophisticated radio equipment you've ever seen. There was intercommunication in every room. You could walk into any room in the house and talk to anybody in the house.
What sort of a house was this? It was a private residence?
Yes, a big detached house.
Really?
Yes.
Who lived there?
Presumably the head of the SS in the area. It was an SS training area.
Oh, right.
Where all the Hitler Youth fanatics had to go for the training. Yeah, and they were defending it to the last man.
How depressing was it going into Germany?
The most depressing of all was that we went to Balsen. Yeah. And that was terribly depressing.
So were you one of the early people in
there? Yeah. We didn't go there to do anything particular, but I think
How did you get instructions to go there, or how did you?
Well, I think we were quite near at the time. And I think they wanted British troops to see what was going on, because it was the first concentration camps that the British had overrun.
Mm. Had you heard about them before?
No, we hadn't, surprisingly enough. No. No.
So did you know what you were going to?
No. No.
Had you any idea? You could call it prisoners of war camp?
No. We thought it was strange because we hadn't smelt the smell since the days of Normandy. Normandy had a reek of death about it, but then when we got into Belgium and Holland, it was different. It was open country and quite pleasant, in a way. But as you approached Belsen, the same old smell and the old fear was there. Mm. Yeah.
So what did you do when you got there?
We were running in. We were taking supplies in for the medical team, actually, that were there. Yeah, that's all.
Is there any way you can sum up what you thought when you saw the people?
Indescribable. You're not prepared for it at all. I don't know. I think a lot of these things, your mind finds a way of coping with what your eyes are seeing. And gives you a certain message, and that has to suffice for the time, doesn't it? Mm. Mm.
What were the medics doing there? I mean, these were British Army medics.
Yes, yes. British, and there were some local medical people there as well, apparently. Not necessarily German, but DPs were medical people, and they were helping. And I think what they were mainly doing was that they were trying to introduce some feeding program for them to get over the malnutrition. I don't know, but I should imagine it would be a rather tricky medical thing to do, really. The temptation would be to give them a big meal, but that would have killed them. So.
What sort of date was this? Have you any idea? I mean, what month would it be? Was this before VE Day?
Yes. So it'd be about April time, I should think, about April. Mm. Yeah.
So you were just very young men, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
Were you 20?
20.
So it must have been rather sort of sober journey back out of
there. Oh, it was, yes. Yeah. And another thing that surprised me that I've read since, people claiming that because the war was nearly over, that it was somehow different. But of course, at the time, nobody knew when the war was going to be over. I mean, we were still sending out patrols the day before Wie Idee into Germany. Although we'd reached Hamburg and Hamburg had surrendered to the Allies, we were still sending out patrols the day before.
Yes.
And our lads could have just as easily been killed that day as any other day.
Where were you based when you went into Belsen?
It was just part of one day's journey, actually.
You were still on the move.
We were still on the move, and we were told that they wanted medical supplies taking up, and they wanted the support convoy. Because you never moved anything in Germany without some support. Because you never knew what you... I mean, the civilians, you couldn't trust them anyway. So you didn't know who they might be hiding or...
The civilians you saw, I mean, the ones by the roadside or in the street, I mean, were they antagonistic to you, I mean, apart from the
Nazis
waving
the flags? Sullen. The only flags they displayed were white sheets.
Which you took to mean what?
Surrender. Because we knew then that the Allies' terms was total surrender, unconditional.
So that was that
was that was the Germans' way of saying, well, you know, okay, we've surrendered.
Do you think they were wanting the German high command to surrender quicker than they did? I mean, they'd given up already, had they?
Well, I think they'd given up when they knew the British army was on in the area. But as the young Nazis showed that. They didn't think they'd given up, and they were prepared to continue fighting. And maybe the message hadn't got through to everybody, but I mean, we still met up with resistance from the German army, even from some of the ragtag and bobtail bits and pieces that were left behind, the Hungarian and Romanian and Polish conscripts that had been drafted into the German army. But the most dismal sight of all was the DPs and the forced labour camp people that we came across, clogging up the roads. And
well, they would be just walking on the roads.
Well, as soon as they even got the hint that the Allied troops were near, of course they left the farms and the buildings and the factories that they'd been sent to try to get away. They didn't want to stay near them for a minute longer than they needed to. So.
What sort of people were they?
Mainly East European. It's hard to tell what they were because their clothing and their general state, you couldn't tell. They were very dispirited and dejected people.
And that infected you, did it? But...
Well... I mean, when you were in France and Holland and Belgium, you were liberating people, and that gave you more of a lift. Whereas in Germany, I mean, the only people you were liberating were the forced labour people, the captive labour market that they'd got. And all they wanted to do was to go home. They didn't want to cheer you or give you a bottle of champagne. They just wanted to go home. And most of them didn't even know where home was anymore. I mean, a lot of them didn't even know where they were in relation to where they lived. So they just clogged the streets and the roads. Masses of people just going wherever they thought there was some way of getting away from the Germans. So.
And nothing that anyone could really do anything about, really?
No, no. Now, it was a problem that continued well after the end of the war and into the 1940s, late 40s. DPs were still being moved around.
So, where did you go to next in Germany? You worked your way?
Worked our way up to Hamburg, where we finished on VE Day.
Yeah. So you were in Hamburg?
In Hamburg, on VE Day.
What was that like?
Well, for me... I got up on the morning of was it May the 8th, and the sergeant came to me and he said, "Aren't you a lucky so-and-so?" So I said, "Why?" He said, "You're going on leave this morning." So I had breakfast and went on leave. And I got to London 2 days later, and there wasn't a pint of beer to be had or a packet of cigarette to be had in London for anything. The city had drank itself dry. And so it was rather a dismal homecoming, really. I'd missed the celebrations in Hamburg and I'd missed the celebrations in London. So there you are.
What was it like coming home?
Oh, it's a great relief. But I was no longer content to go back to my village. So I spent the leave in London, I think, with Joe's family. And I can't remember much about the leave, actually. He wasn't there, but his family made me welcome, and I spent the leave with them.
And then you went back to...
So I went back to Hamburg, and when I got back to Hamburg, we were moving the next day to Solingen, so we drove all the way back down to Solingen in Germany, which is near Düsseldorf. And that was to be our base, our location. And we were there until March 46, when the reconnaissance units were all disbanded.
Right. And where did you go then?
I spent the time when they were at Solingen. We'd set up a divisional leave point, and I was there for quite some time. I ran it for a while as well, without getting any promotion.
You're still a trooper.
Yeah. And acting corporal occasionally. But I got tonsillitis just before Christmas, and I was taken to hospital in Düsseldorf, and CO came to see me, and he said, "Is there anything you want that I can get for you?" I said, "Well, the only thing I want to do is get out of here before Christmas." So he said, "I'll see what I can do for you." So he did. I got out before Christmas, and I was back in again on New Year's Day with the same thing, with tonsillitis again.
And who was your CO?
It was Leo Williams, yeah. So
so you had Christmas out, but
yes,
back again.
And back again. And I don't remember much about it, because you get lightheaded with tonsillitis in the high fever and so on. The first time I was in, they treated me with penicillin, which was the miracle cure at the time, and it worked marvellous. And of course, the second time I went back, he said, "We can't give you penicillin because you've just had a course." So they gave me what I think they call them M&B tablets, and they're about the size of a half crown, which is the last thing you want when you've got tonsillitis, but there you are. Anyway, it cured it. So. Well, when the recce was disbanded, we were sent to Wuppertal in Germany, and to the North Irish Horse. And I think that lasted about 6 weeks, and they were disbanded then. And then we were sent to Lübeck, to the 10th Hussars, and that's where I stayed until I got demobbed.
Right. And what were you doing in Lübeck?
Well, in Lübeck, we had to do... we had two patrol points. Our job was to patrol the border between East and West Germany, between the Russian zone and the Allied zone. And Lübeck, as you probably know, is up on the peninsula. And we used to go to two points from Lübeck and carry out patrols every morning to try to get the border crossers, people who were fleeing from the eastern zone. And we used to have to collect them up and process them, and the perk for the job was you had to confiscate the hooch. They always used to carry hooch with them to bribe the guards to bribe the East German and the Russians to let them through. And they thought if they had an extra bottle, they would you know, curry favour with the Allies on their side. We used to confiscate all the hooch.
Why did you think then that they were fleeing over the border?
Because of the conditions that were there.
So did you feel any pang of guilt that you were sending them back to worse conditions, you know?
No, I mean, they were still Germans, weren't they? I mean, we didn't really care what happened to them as Germans. They were just making life miserable for us, really. I mean, they were just problems as far as we could see. It would be better for us if they'd have stayed where they were and we'd had nothing to do.
Were you all getting a bit disillusioned with the sort of war and everything now? It was sort of over.
The occupation of Germany... life in the Tent Hussars really wasn't all that bad. They were known as the Shiny Tent because they liked to have polished brasses and buttons and everything else, much like the 53rd Recce did. But when we were in the Tent Hussars, it was a full-time regular army regiment, the Tent Hussars, with history going back to, you know, when Adam was a boy. And as a little aside, we were given history lessons when we were in the Tent Hussars, time-passing things. And this officer was telling us the history of the Tent Hussars, you know, from 1635 or something, and this battle and that battle and all that. And one of our lads, who was ready for the mob, said, and what did you do with... in the last war? And there was a hushed silence, you see. And eventually we were told that they were employed in the Italian campaign. And we since learned, and I don't know whether this shocked the Tent Hussars, but we were told that they were fully equipped with brand new Sherman tanks in Italy. And they went into battle, and apparently they deployed all the tanks, which I understand is not the right thing to do. You should keep some in reserve, but they deployed all these new tanks they'd got, and the Italians decimated them. Not the Germans, the Italians. And the story has it that the high command decided that they weren't to be trusted and they never sent into battle again. But they had a glorious history.
Yeah. So you battle-hardened youngsters. Well, when you were still
this was the point, because in the 10th Hussars, they were constantly receiving new recruits. And we were looked upon as hardened veterans of the war. You know, not even their officers and their sergeants had our experience, you see. So... we never had to go down for breakfast even. They used to just say, one of the recruits, just bring us something back, will you? And they used to bring you a mug of tea and a plate with breakfast on, you know. You hadn't bother going down to the house for your breakfast, you know. But the same of needing, when they were going out, they'd say to lads, are you going to Naffy? Oh, bring us something back. And, you know, they used to come up and bring it all back for you, you see. You didn't bother.
And you were allowed to do that?
Oh, yes. Yes. And of course we used to take the officers for a ride as well, because they had no experience, they didn't know anything. I mean, they used to give us instructions on small arms, you know. And we said to them, when did you last fire a Thompson machine gun in anger? No answer, you see.
So the army was just trying to keep you occupied until you were demobbed.
That's right, until I had demob. Yeah. And... I spent a lot of my time in the Tent Hussars. I used to be a regular visitor to the sergeant's mess, because I knew quite a few of the sergeants there, and we used to go out of an evening together, and they did.